All right, welcome back everyone to week number four, or episode number four of Things We Read This Week. I'm Jordan Nanos, back with Hunter Almgren. This week we've got the He Said, She Said episode. We're going to talk about Hindenburg research on Supermicro. We're going to talk about NVIDIA getting subpoenaed by the DOJ, OpenAI making a plea during their copyright case with the New York Times and others. Gonna be a fun episode, but before we jump into that, Hunter, what'd you work on these past 2 weeks?
Yeah, these past 2 weeks have been quite busy building out phase two of a large GPU training cluster, building out scale out storage for large training clusters, building out software demos for customers, you know, all that fun stuff. That's all I do now, actually, is just AI. It's infrastructure for AI, demos for AI, use cases for AI. All I do now. You might as well just change my title to AI guy, because that's pretty much it at this point.
It used to be HA, because you were the big backup guy, right? Everything had to be highly available with Hunter Almgren, but now it's just AI. So I think you need a change of initials or something like that.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
What did you do the last 2 weeks?
I've been taking some time off. Yeah, that's about it. Yeah, keep it quiet and secretive for now. But not as much hard work as you. A different kind of hard work, let's say. So,
for sure.
Yeah. Let's dig into some of this. I think the first place we can start is just with the AI solutions, last thing you mentioned. So obviously people use AI for a lot of different things. And I want to talk about software development, like the concept of writing code, because I think there's competing schools of thought here. Like, in one hand, people seem to say like AI is going to solve everything and the software engineers have automated themselves out of a job already. And then on the other hand, there's a lot of people saying, yeah, this is cool to build a demo, but like 90% of AI products don't work. And I think it can kind of both be true. So first thing I'll share is a tweet I saw from this guy, Peter Barazin, who apparently there's a tracker from Fred. I'm not sure exactly where they get this data, if it's like LinkedIn, Indeed, some other place, but, you know, it's a Federal Reserve Bank, right? So you'd think the data is trustworthy, and there's like a huge peak in openings for software development jobs in 2022, and it's been a big reduction, let's say, to the mean for 2024 of what we saw in 2021, 2020, and beyond, and before. But it's effectively like a doubling from whatever the index is of 100 all the way up to 220, 240 space, and now down to like 80. Are you seeing similar stuff? Like, organizations are either not hiring new grads, they're not expanding existing teams, they're cutting, like laying off people, because the obvious culprit is Copilot and similar like code generation experiences, right?
Yeah, I think that I have not seen like mass layoffs of software developers from companies that I know for a fact have implemented some sort of coding assistant solution. I haven't personally taken a look at their open job postings to see like have they slowed down hiring of software developers, but I'm not seeing mass layoffs. And I think part of that is, and I kind of sit somewhere in the middle between it's going to solve everything and it's a piece of shit and doesn't work. I think that you're not going to get to a point where you fully remove the human in the loop as it relates to software development, right? Because you still need somebody to fact check the model to see whether it wrote good code or not, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it forgot a subroutine. Maybe there, you know, as we know, AI is prone to hallucinations. AI makes mistakes, right? There's plenty of documented examples of that, right? And so while I do believe that there are notable efficiency gains in the software development lifecycle by using coding assistants, I don't believe that the human element is ever going to be able to be removed. I don't care how good the model is, right? I mean, you're talking about, in some cases, code that has the ability to affect whether someone lives or dies. When you get to that level of programming, right? Like when you have applications and code that runs on, think about it, right? Like runs on embedded medical devices, right? That's code that, like, if the pacemaker, if the code that's keeping the pacemaker running stops, you're in trouble. So, I mean, if you think about it from that perspective, right? I don't think you can ever truly remove the human in the loop. Now, I also, at least just from my own personal experience, know that, at least in like web development, for example, there's a lot of like menial code tasks that have to be done to build a website, right? Like there's stuff that like nobody wants to write because it's not creative. It's just like, you know, tying the front end web page to a back end database and like building all the scripts and like, you know, the menial tasks. That stuff is going to go towards coding assistants, right? Because I don't need to spend time on that because it's always going to be the same. There's like, in a lot of cases with stuff like, with examples like that, there's a right way and a wrong way. It's like, you know, it's one or a zero, right? It's very binary. So why don't I just offload that to an assistant? That way I can focus on the actual creative programming work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it does seem like there's two things. There's a long tail of more and more complicated stuff that's not going to get replaced. But there's also this consistent feeling that I've had in AI where it's like, okay, sure, the model can do this, but then we're going to move the goalposts and say, but it can never do this. So one of the things was like building the environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you can write a single Python file that works. You can add comments. You can explain things when I have a question about it. This model's good at that. But you can't. You could never run the Docker commands to build the container, to push it into the registry, to, you know, deploy the database, to use some cloud service to, you know, some web service to deploy it, blah, blah, blah. Except actually, okay, some of these models can now. Like,
yeah,
they can do these.
They can.
Bash commands. They can build a script. They can reason across multiple files. They can reason across your existing repository. And so I'm always concerned about the like moving the goalposts thing here. But it also does feel like there's an aspect of, there's echoes of the everything I remember from self-driving, right? Like initially there's no way this tech is going to work. Then, oh my gosh, this is actually really good. It's kind of more trustworthy than me. And then, no, there's some really scary edge cases where this thing doesn't work. And all the result is like, it's going to take longer than we think, right? It's not going to happen. It's just probably not going to happen next year that we go from, you know, 100 on the Fred ranking index, 100 software engineers to two. You know, it's right. Like maybe we're going from 100 to 90 to 80 to 70. And
so just like a much slower progression.
Seems to be to me that most of these trends are going slower than we forecast. It's I think we have a hard time with exponentials and we have a hard time with square roots, like laws with some diminishing returns, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a exponential inverse. So anyway. Interesting stuff with coding assistants world. I think there's a lot to dig into there, whether you think about GitHub Copilot, you think about open source projects like continue.dev, you look at some of the announcements from Cursor, from Replit. it seems to me that there's two primary AI experiences right now. One is a chatbot, where you can chat about just about anything, and you kind of need to customize it depending on if you want to chat with your database, or you want to chat with your PDF documents, or you want to chat with your CRM or your emails or whatever it is. And then the second experience is coding. There's other ones. These LLMs can be used for to like generate images. They can be used to synthesize audio, create music, and things like that. But the two primary ones that it seems to me is like natural language, English or another language, and then code as like the second kind of medium or interface in which you're going to interact with these things. Mm-hmm. So more to come, I guess, about coding and stuff like that.
Well, that brings up another question, though, right? I mean, let's assume we get to the point where a coding assistant is good enough to start firing developers en masse. Is the company willing to invest in the infrastructure resources to support that? Because you would think for a model to be able to do that, it would be very demanding in terms of compute resources to make that happen. So at what point do hiring developers become cheaper than buying all this infrastructure to make these models actually do more of a developer's job? I think
that's such an important point. So I think for two reasons. One is that I think a lot of people have a misconception of what software engineers do. They mm-hmm. usually get paid to think, not get paid to type. And these models are faster at typing, but most of a software engineer's day is not spent typing. Mm-hmm. So that reduction in time to push code will need to come from a source of the model's creativity or efficiency or, you know, something in the realm of reasoning and logic and thinking, as opposed to just like it can pound out 100 tokens a second. That's faster than somebody can type.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is just in terms of quality, right? So in my experience using these models, it's when I generate code, it's basically that I can generate a prototype quicker. I can write a unit test quicker. I can explain something that I haven't reviewed before quicker. Like I can ask a question, get a response. All of this is the classic co-pilot or assistant experience where like I'm mm-hmm. still in the driving seat. I'm not the passenger. And I fundamentally, and maybe I just don't have enough experience using these models and stuff, but I've not had the feeling that the model's in the driver's seat and I'm in the passenger seat as the navigator, just kind of poking it this way and that way. Change the color to red, you know, make this component snappy. But I don't do UI development. And I think the demos that I've seen the most of are for front-end engineers, where the engineers are like, hey, we like it's important that we let's imagine they can A/B test two different banners quicker because it's quicker to generate that component from the model.
Yeah.
I mean, that's value to the organization, and it's certainly a place where there's a speed, but it's like, okay, somebody review this, you know, numerical kernel in like a weather code, think really hard about it, make it go a little bit faster. Seems like that's going to be some of the later stuff. Run these benchmarks for these new GPUs. Debug the drivers in this new GPU system. It's like, mm-hmm. I don't know, man. Seems a little bit different.
Yeah, so one of the... I actually was experimenting with this yesterday. So I took a piece of COBOL code that I know runs, and I had a coding assistant convert the whole thing to Java for me, right? Because I'm thinking of a use case of like a bank or credit union or somebody in financial services who's still stuck on mainframe, a lot of old COBOL code, they want to move to x86. Mm-hmm. Well, you have to convert to Java, right? That's typically the path of least resistance. You know, in fact, IBM's Watson X, that's one of the things that they advertise is give us all your COBOL code and we'll convert it to Java for you. And you can pay us money to refactor your applications automatically. I ran the Java code and it doesn't run. I'm not a Java developer. So I have no idea what's broken, right? So like, that's just one real world example I ran into yesterday of like, I took a COBOL application I know for a fact works. What it spit out in rewritten in Java doesn't run. So what broke, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the assistant thing, right? Which is where you're it feels like in that scenario, you're in the driver's seat, the model's in the passenger seat, kind of helping you navigate, and you've got to learn something. Yeah. And the model can be a tool to help you learn, but it may take some Googling, some looking at docs, some talking to a human expert, or it may take some improvements in the model. Because the other experience with this AI stuff is like, when it works, it works. It's like life of a turkey, you know? Not dead, not dead, not dead. Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah.
Model can't do it, can't do it, can't do it, can do it, never think about it again. It can always do it for the rest of the time, right? And this is the worst it's ever going to be. That's kind of my favorite saying right now. Like,
yeah.
So we're sitting here right now. We've currently got, and here's another story that I read this week, which is just fantastic. So Llama 3.1 gets dropped. It's open source. And then this guy, Matt Schumer, fine tunes it using this method he calls reflection, which is just fantastic. Reflection tuning. The model can correct its own mistakes. It's so cool. So now the 70 billion parameter version of Llama 3.1, which is also open source. He has released it under the Llama license, as you have to do if you build on Llama 3.1, has better performance than the closed source, multi-billion funded Claude 3.5 Sonnet from Anthropic, Claude 3 Opus from Anthropic, GPT-4o from OpenAI, and Gemini 1.5 Pro from Google. Right, it's outperforming these things in meaningful benchmarks, at least benchmarks that these labs publish numbers for. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We'll yet to see if this is exactly, if it's going to pass the vibe test for every single user's individual application. But the power of open source on display here, and yeah, it's like it's incredible that. And maybe it's hype. Maybe it's just some guy on Twitter or whatever. But the trend is what I was commenting on, that as you improve these models over time, it's like the last one that you, the latest one you've got access to is the worst one you'll ever use for the future, right?
Yeah.
So
certainly a true statement.
Yeah.
I mean, you say that about software development in general. I mean, the alpha or the 1.0 release is the crappiest it'll ever be, theoretically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this stuff is software.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to some
spiciness,
higher level stuff. Yeah, so the he said, she said, as I said in the intro.
Yeah.
Which one you want to go? Which him and her you want to go for first?
Well, let's start with Supermicro. So August 27th, Hindenburg Research, a notorious short seller, published an article accusing Supermicro of misrepresenting, you know, accounting errors, how they're basically selling to countries on the no-no list, right? So they're failing at export control and other issues, right? And these are some pretty serious accusations, I would say, especially the export control run, right? Because that gets you banned from every federal agency, like from doing business, right? Like you go on the no-no list of companies we're not allowed to buy from anymore. You know, see Kaspersky as a perfect example of, you know, government not allowed to buy that software anymore. Same kind of thing here with hardware. So this is some pretty serious accusations. And also, I would point out that Hindenburg Research has a pretty crazy track record. If you actually look in their like about us section, you know, some of the investigations and reports that they've released have resulted in people literally going to jail for fraud. And, you know, I was actually reading through a few of them this morning. Of one guy got in a 4-hour standoff and shootout with the FBI. Like, their research has resulted in some pretty wild things. Supermicro CEO then responds a week later and says, no, this is false and inaccurate statements about the company. We're not, you know, we're not engaged in any shady accounting practices here. You know, we're not, you know, failing at export controls. Like none of that is basically none of that is true. However, what's interesting is this statement right here. So when Hindenburg Research published their analysis, the next day, Supermicro delayed submitting their 10K. Usually you would delay submitting your 10K if it was inaccurate, right? Or you had to go back and fix something.
Right.
So this brings up an interesting point of, well, is Hindenburg correct? And this is just damage control on Supermicro's part? Or is Hindenburg missing something? I think that's the big question right now.
Yeah, I think it's hard to speculate on all of this stuff without more information. I'm sure it'll slowly come out in drips and drabs over time. The one thing that I can say for certain is that it seems like Hindenburg Research does. So they've got this focus on technology, in my view, because I see the stuff about Equinix earlier this year. I see the stuff about Supermicro now. And it seems different than others in the past, especially knowing Equinix, knowing Supermicro a little bit, which is to say, like, this stuff does exist. I don't want to come to the, be seen as like coming to the defense of these guys and stuff, but it's like there are accounting errors and, like, you know, people getting aggressive on the sales side and then committing fraud. And then there's like, I would say legitimate fraud, which is, or another level of fraud, it seems, where like they're just making things up out of thin air. And, you know, the idea of like, you're going to ship a crate with a gum wrapper in it to hit some year end thing that somebody accepts. And then you're going to follow it up with the real order later. It seems like a practice that has been widespread in the IT industry, which is not a good thing and is, I guess, fraud or needs to be litigated, but it's this gray area thing that seems a little different than some of the other Hindenburg stuff that you're mentioning, where people are like doing fully criminal things, like individual criminal things, as opposed to a business, you know, massaging the numbers and then paying the price of being down 65% in the last 6 months for the chart that I'm looking at on Supermicro stock.
Well, and there have been instances. We saw this a lot with the whole GameStop stock craze. A lot of people calling for these short sellers to be banned in some way by the SEC because essentially they're taking out massive positions against the company and then basically releasing what equates to a hit piece in order to manipulate the stock. And, you know, the SEC, stock manipulation is illegal, but like this has always been a little bit of a gray area, I feel, where like, is it stock manipulation if you have supposed facts or evidence to back it up, despite the fact that you're making tons of money off of it? I don't know.
Yeah, the facts and evidence in this case is pretty obvious. Like,
yeah,
it's like you look at it and there's an interview with a large former customer of Supermicro saying they switched vendors because of Supermicro doing these things that they're accusing them of.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, you know, that's a firsthand account. So that stuff is pretty obvious. I think that what's particularly interesting on the technical side is just the gap in the industry that appears, which is to say, Supermicro has always been viewed as a low cost, high volume vendor that's going to operate at low margins in this space. And the servers now have GPUs in them, so now they're an AI company, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's room for a premium experience in this space that seems to be missing a little bit, where you don't have a failure rate of 17% on the servers. Like one in five shows up broken. You know? That can be better, you know. If like one in five Toyotas was leaving the lot and just like
didn't
not
drive.
Powering on, yeah, you're like, hey, Toyota has a problem.
Like, right.
But instead, because the business of data centers is like running a taxi fleet where you're buying 1,000 Toyotas at the same time, suddenly this one in five doesn't work experience is just like washed away. Oh, whatever. We'll just go swap out a brake pedal.
Yeah, I mean, people just immediately dismiss it as like, oh, this is the problem with mass manufacturing. This is what we've always had to deal with, you know, like people get bad batches of hard drives, you know, for example, where like they have a 15, 20% failure rate out of 1,000 hard drives. But OK, we'll just swap it out for more drives.
I kind of reject that. So there's an organization, many organizations, but basically just TSMC printing out these incredibly complicated, like incredibly detailed chips onto these wafers. They're sending them for package and assembly. They're sending them for test. They show up. And now there's, you know, Jensen held up this H100 so people can see. It's a famous photo, right? He's got the size of his torso. Mm-hmm. He's like, there's 40,000 components on this thing or whatever it is, you know, and that thing works. And then the company that's bending the metal around it, I can't make it happen. Basically, there's issues on the motherboard. And you're like, wait a second. So they could accomplish this with ultraviolet light, and you can't cool the thing? It seems like there's a different ends of the bargain that need to be held up and figured out here, right?
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. I was more just saying that, like, that's typically how people dismiss these issues. I hear it a lot.
Excuse away the the DOA, the dead on arrival server with really unknown methods to figure out why in many cases. And
yeah,
just
I hear it all the time.
Send it back to the factory and get a new one.
Yep. I hear it all the time. That's more what I was saying is like.
And how many times do you hear it? Do they pull out the chips, send the chips for diags or the network cards or the memory or whatever?
Never.
And like every single chip or memory or drive is dead. It's like never. Those have gone through QA, right?
Right.
But for some reason, we don't apply the same standards to the, I'm saying the metal that's bent around it. There's obviously more in that. But fascinating kind of. It, to me, it's like there's people in the financial markets who have been very sophisticated, like financial thinkers, who are now getting introduced to some of the details of the IT industry. Like we said on the last episode, like Elon talking about how this thing's like a brain, you got to plug in all these things.
Yeah.
Like this is a guy who's rocket science and then electric cars, and now he's spending his time talking about how complicated data centers are. So it's kind of in the zeitgeist. And now the financial guys are asking questions. Why do 17.5% of these things show up DOA? A question that I've had for years.
I think the analysts are starting to figure it out, that maybe there's something that needs to be dug into here that, you know, nobody's actually digging into, because for as long as I can remember listening to earnings calls, the questions the analysts throw out are generally pretty generic and financial focused. Like, are you going to raise your guidance for the rest of the year? Do you expect an EPS raise before X date? You know, what is your profitability on this product category? And now they're like, why are these things showing up dead 17% of the time? So you're right. I mean,
you're a low margin business. Doesn't that impact margin?
Yeah, exactly. You already sell these things at cost. So if 17% of them fail and you have to replace it, wouldn't that mean that you're negative 17% margin? Something's not adding up here.
Okay. Let's move on to something else. I brought up chips. NVIDIA's got a subpoena from the DOJ, according to Bloomberg.
Allegedly, yes.
But according to NVIDIA, they don't have one.
Yeah, according to NVIDIA, fake news, never happened. This is an interesting one because I'm admittedly a little surprised that the DOJ would take such an interest in NVIDIA's market position. Like, I get that they have a dominant position and a lot of things are NVIDIA, 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 but at the same time, like, it's not like other accelerators and software packages just straight up don't exist.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we know that there's, at least from a mainstream perspective, like, we know that AMD's got their Instinct GPUs. We know that Intel's got Gaudi 2 with Gaudi 3 right around the corner. We know that there's the other more, I would say, maybe not niche players, but, like, you know, you've got your graph cores and your Cerebruses, and then you've got these startups like Etched and some of these others coming to market. You've also got TensorTorrent, right, which I feel like is a little bit more specific of a use case. I guess I'm curious. What's that?
Grok with a Q is a good one, serving up long
tokens.
It's super interesting. I want to make one comment, get your take on this. NVIDIA. So antitrust, I don't have a, you know, being a Canadian, I don't have a lot of, and not a lawyer, I don't have a lot of understanding of how the U.S. regulatory system works. Getting a sense over time, spending more time in business. It seems that antitrust has to do with tactics.
Yes.
In the business, right? So, like, bundling is a tactic that people don't like because you can put little competitors out of business by giving away their stuff for free, undercutting people, right? Now, the idea of monopolies in Canada, there was this thing where, like, the grocery stores fixed bread prices and then had to give everybody money back who had bought bread.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't.
Was that Loblaws?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Other grocery stores as well. Yeah. But yeah. Exactly. So there's a lot of, like, I think there's a large surface area of different things that the DOJ could be investigating. NVIDIA has a dominant market position with real competition and a growing market.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds good. Do they also have some anti-competitive tactics? Buying out all of the supply at TSMC, the one vendor that can actually produce leading edge materials. Yeah. So I'd rather not have NVIDIA get slowed down because I like this market and think it's good for everybody.
Yeah.
But I'm also sitting there and going, like, letting AMD have a run at TSMC would probably be a nice thing as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think also, like, one of the things that I've noticed that could be a potential area of investigation that, like, I've noticed that AMD and Intel and others don't really do, or at least they don't advertise it. I've never heard of it. You know, NVIDIA's, like, whole, you know, developer researcher ecosystem, like how they go to market, right? Where, like, they get the practitioners hooked on NIMS and like all these other software packages. And it's like, oh, well, like you have to use NVIDIA chips. So then they buy NVIDIA chips. And then it's like, well, you have to connect these on a NVIDIA network. So now you buy the NVIDIA network. And it's like, oh, you can only buy NVIDIA certified storage platforms. So now I have to go get a certified storage platform. And my choices just shrink, 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 shrink. That's an area where I could see the DOJ taking an issue with, because that is, on the surface, if not completely, very close to an anti-competitive practice, right? Where they're trying, Apple's under fire for this right now. I mean, the European Union has already basically said, you know, fuck your walled garden app store. Like, you need to allow alternative third-party app stores within your ecosystem.
Yeah, but that, and that's a really good comparison. It makes total sense to me. But it to shine the light back on it, NVIDIA's had like, what, 6 months at the top of the table here? It's like 3 years in the conversation of being a big company.
Mm-hmm.
I think these tactics exist, bundling at Microsoft, App Store, you know, penalization stuff at pay-to-play things at Apple, Google paying everybody to put the search engine in there, you know, Amazon with all the kind of undercutting everybody and putting small companies out of business with the Amazon Basic stuff. There's a lot of marginally, you know, interesting tactics. Like, does this say that NVIDIA is running a little lean and mean and needs to hire some more lobbyists? Like, why are they getting the ire of the DOJ with anti-competitive tactics when quote unquote big tech seems to be doing just fine and not really having the light shone on them as much?
It is interesting. I think a potential reason why they may be getting more scrutiny is because, I forget who said it, it was like a month ago, someone made the comment that like NVIDIA should be protected as a critical like asset or something for national defense or something along those lines, right? Like they basically said like NVIDIA is so critical to all of these different systems and technology innovation and everything that was going on that like they need to be like, we need to basically protect them and not let them sell to our enemies and not let them do XYZ, right, globally. And I'm almost wondering if that maybe has something to do with it. Like the DOJ is more or less maybe not going after them like a lawsuit, but more like probing for information. Like, hey, what are you guys doing? Who are you selling to? What, you know, like basically like how are you running this business?
Yeah.
So it could be something as benign as that, right? Where they're just they're basically making an information request out of the subpoena, like, hey, we need you to turn over these records so that we can see like what the hell you guys are doing.
Yeah, and it makes sense. So that's a good segue to another one that I shared with you. I haven't gone through this in a lot of detail, and there's a lot of like interesting tidbits in here, I think, but there's a yearly tracker called the Critical Technology Tracker from an institution called ASPI. It's funded by Australian Defense. And they go through who is the leader in research in given technologies. They track 64 key technologies, and they now put China as the leader in 57 out of 64 key technologies. The U.S. leads the other seven. So to the point about who is NVIDIA selling chips to, me reading about this, and then also the book Chip War, I think gives a little bit of background as to if the most important technology in the world is AI right now, which is really, and we always kind of jump around on this, but it's really like, hey, AI is software. It's kind of, the scope of it is kind of expanded to just mean all software, right?
Yeah.
All computers. Well, all computers kind of depend on integrated circuit design and fabrication. And if you look at the country rankings here, at least at the research perspective, China has leapfrogged the US, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think anybody with like an understanding of the industry as well, and who follows some of the academic publications and stuff would kind of, in a sense, think like, yeah, okay. Let's not even talk about chips. So something I'm familiar with is the AI models right now, right? I think a lot of people would be like, okay, Llama is popular, OpenAI. On the industry side, these are not Chinese companies. The number one embedding model is BGE, which is made by Chinese academics at the Beijing Institute of something. I don't even remember. BAII or something like that. When there's lots of models that are coming out of China, and there's lots of reason to believe that China's working on their own chips. I mean, they produce their own GPUs right now.
Yeah.
So, and with the backdrop of reading this book, Chip War, I'm not all the way through it, but it's definitely helps me with a little bit of the history of some of this stuff. You hear words like, you hear about people like Andy Grove and Gordon Moore and Intel and Fairchild Semiconductor and stuff, mm-hmm. Samsung, Texas Instruments. Where did this stuff come from? Reading a little bit about Japan's rise in the 80s, because I wasn't around for it, has been helpful to understand, like, yeah, the CHIPS Act right now, like, this is a thing that has been going on for decades, where companies that produce leading edge technologies go to U.S. the Congress, generally speaking, but specifically like defense funding, and ask for help because it's a matter of national security.
Yep.
Right. At the time, it was like the chips control guided missiles. Yeah. Now it's like literally the model itself could be strategically important, something mm-hmm. like that. So,
yeah, for doing combat, augmented reality stuff, like identifying. Yeah, there was a cool use case I remember seeing last year of like taking live footage from a drone camera and like correctly identifying like not only like this is a tank, this is a plane, this is a Humvee, but then also like being able to identify the insignia on the vehicle to see like, is this friend or foe? Right. So basically doing like combat surveys in near real time by using like object detection and recognition and stuff like that. You could argue that that's a national security use case. And thus, you know, we should be the recipient of all of your tasty DOD dollars that get doled out every year.
Well, yeah. And you can talk about how it doesn't seem to be a linear relationship between amount of funding going in and amount of academic research going out. That was one of the points that the guy made, right? It's something to do with motivation, something to do with focus. And there's a lot there, but connecting it back, look, a DOJ inquiry into anybody getting published is probably not a great thing. NVIDIA says they haven't gotten a subpoena. Maybe that's a, maybe that's specifically nitpicking on the word subpoena, and there's been some other thing that's going on. You got to imagine the big companies have some relationship on the public government side for all sorts of things that they're doing.
And, yeah, I mean, like I said, right? Like, so the U.S. government has a process where, you know, it's the Freedom of Information Act, right? So you can submit a FOIA request to the government to say, I want more information from you on this that's not necessarily published, and they have to give it to you, right? Obviously, they can redact the hell out of it and make it just look like a bunch of black bars, and you're like, great, what do I do with this? But they have to give it to you. I mean, maybe Bloomberg is mischaracterizing this as a subpoena, and it was more of like an information request that the DOJ sent. Like, because you wouldn't categorize a FOIA request as a subpoena to the federal government. Like, you wouldn't characterize it that way.
It'd be an inquiry. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be some sort of we're looking into them.
I guess,
but last month, I'm reading the article right now. Last month, the information reported the DOJ has launched an investigation into the company after complaints from competitors showed that it had abused its market dominance. So now it's a subpoena. This would be a level up, which I think it probably has. It's interesting that they just said they don't have a subpoena. I don't know. He said, she
What
said,
subpoena? What subpoena?
man.
We don't have any subpoenas around here.
Wait, are you saying Jensen's running around the city streets trying to avoid the person serving him with
The
the
process server, he's just like ducking in alleys and stuff, like avoiding the guy, like, you've been served.
There is this thing about, Shaq is like a TV personality. He was getting served in the FTX case,
Yeah.
and he would get like moved around by security. It took them months to get him served or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, dude, people like,
Oh
especially at that level, man, like you have enough money to hire an entire team to duck process servers. Like, yeah, I mean, you've got like a small country's army of people basically helping you dodge a process server at that point.
Okay. Let's segue into another thing. Speaking of people who have lots of money to dodge things. OpenAI has pleaded that it can't make money without using copyrighted materials for free. We've talked about this before.
We have.
Please, sir, I need my free copyright materials. How can I ever be the fastest growing company of all time? What do you take on this? It seems like there's a lot of scrutiny. This is not like a wide open free for all market right now. There's a lot of scrutiny. We just talked about kind of national defense concerns, anti-competitive concerns. Now there's these IP and copyright concerns. Everybody's got an issue with AI.
Yeah. So my take on, like, I kind of my first reaction to that news was like, okay, Sam, go fuck yourself. Like, you have the money to pay these people for access to your data. Don't pretend like you don't. I mean, I think that's really what it comes down to, is the New York Times and all, the record labels suing the AI music generation companies, and like, it all comes down to like, pay us, give us money. You want to use it? Money. Like, that's what it is. And we talked about this on a previous episode of how, like, Reddit's entered into an agreement with XYZ company to sell Reddit data to help train models, right? Or like, this is starting to be, I called it, I think, like the AI data economy or whatever, of like people selling data. And it's like, what I don't fully understand is, what is OpenAI's real case here of like, we cannot be the best model in the world unless we get everything for free? I mean, that kind of sounds like what the case is.
Well, yeah, I think there's two important aspects that are different in terms of how this data gets used. One is during pre-training, and one is during retrieval augmented generation. So in the first case, there are ways in which the model will behave based on some combination of like knowledge of current public figures, like New York Times authors,
Sure.
writers and stuff, owners, where the model will know about these people who are public figures because there's lots of content about them on the internet. And then also old New York Times articles or references to articles that are in the public domain and have been for many years. And the models are trained on these open web archives of
Yeah.
this data, right? And so the fact that the model is kind of writing in the style of a New York Times author who's a public figure today because it's read all of these old articles that are in the public domain, like, I don't understand how you can litigate against that outside of having these companies guarantee that they are, that, the whole right to be forgotten, like, you can have a right to be forgotten in pre-training data, which seems technically, to me, technically infeasible. Like, you would. There would need to be some sort of manual human review of a ridiculous amount of data. Like, one of the powerful things about these models is just the fact that they use so much data, right?
Right.
The other thing is that there's like this whole retrieval augmented generation thing, which is a really powerful experience, and it's different than training a foundation model and opening it up. It's like using Perplexity. It's like using something OpenAI released recently, which is like Perplexity. It's like GPT search GPT or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, search GPT.
GPT. So the point of this is like when a model gives a response, when you ask it a question about like, tell me about the latest NVIDIA news, and it tells you about the latest news and it gives you a link to go read about it, it's obviously getting that information from somewhere, like an article that the New York Times just released or something like that. So conceptually, it's like if an organization wants to pay to play or have these people included because they think, like, let's say Perplexity, to keep OpenAI out of it, wants to potentially point people towards Stack Overflow answers for certain, mm-hmm. you know, computer science related questions. It's like Perplexity can pay Stack Overflow and then have those links in there. And it seems like an agreement, like a good agreement. Like it can use the Stack Overflow data to, you know, retrieve that information with those answers to those specific questions and then link to the answer to go check it yourself, right? Go read the discussion more. And to me, actually, it's kind of vice versa. I imagine it more as like Google search being put on the iPhone. Like, wouldn't Stack Overflow as a business want to pay Perplexity to be included at the top of their searches, right?
To drive more traffic, to all the other,
It's at least symbiotic in that mm-hmm. space, right? And so to me, it's very clear that at inference time, when you're doing a RAG application like SearchGPT or like Perplexity, you need to be able to exclude certain sources on the internet from being linked, and you need to be able to promote ones or link certain ones that you want to include, right? And that's sort of the Perplexity advertising partnership thing we were referring to last week, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, the ads team gets together with Nissan, and now anytime somebody mentions a car, you're giving a link to that page. So it can probably pervert the experience a little bit, but it's whatever. That makes sense to me. I don't understand the objection to taking stuff that's in the public domain out of pre-training data. Meanwhile, I obviously understand the objection that OpenAI should not train on private data that they have scraped illegally. And it seems like they've violated stuff already, agreements, law, if they are scraping private data. One fascinating thing, I just throwing it out there, a friend of mine works at Google, and we talked about some of the training they do for models, and he referred to how onerous it is to actually train on customer data at Google because of the terms of service that they have. And he said, you would be surprised. We have a lot of smart people, but everybody says we have a big data advantage. It's really not the case for customer data. We can't train on our customer data. And so OpenAI famously trained their text-to-video model on YouTube data, and Google can't. Google can't, according to their terms of service, can't train text-to-video models on their own YouTube data because of the terms of service they've kind of imposed on themselves. So,
wild.
It's fascinating, man. It's fascinating both from a technical perspective of like, people said we're going to run out of data, and I think a lot of academics have said that's not the case. We're not going to run out of data, but functionally, getting around the like legal loopholes, the agreement loopholes to actually get access to more of those data sets. I don't know how it's going to happen.
Yeah, I don't either. And to your point of what you just said, right? I mean, I've definitely read some articles over the past few months of, you know, I would call them like alarmist publications of like, we're running out of data to train models because everyone's paywalling it. Like, you know, I don't know. I think This is uncharted territory for everyone. I think what I'm very interested in, especially as it relates to this lawsuit, is what the outcome is. Mm-hmm. Because we're effectively, this is one of those instances, you hear about this in the practice of law of like, it's a landmark case, meaning like it decided the policy that every other judge will rule on based on moving forward, right? Could this turn into a landmark ruling? And then all of a sudden, every court, all the way up to the Supreme Court, is like, well, we're going to cite this decision, and this is how we're going to rule.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we literally writing rules right now in real time as part of this lawsuit?
Yeah.
I think that's what's interesting to me about it.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. It's going to set a lot of precedent because the obvious thing to me is that, like, people aren't slowing down. Like, we're now bringing online tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of H100s per Frontier Model Research Lab.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are doing maybe the first thrashes and throws of, like, experimentation and figuring out what works are now, like, being gobbled up and acquired. It's like Inflection goes to Microsoft, Character goes to Google. Right?
Yeah.
There's Anthropic kind of really getting close with Amazon. And now let's set back, tool up. Now we've got H100s. Here's the next generation of models, which in some sense is exciting. In another sense is like a little bit eerie. It's like, oh, this is the calm before the storm. That's kind of the way my feeling goes for it. And the rules of the road, I think, going back to the stock market, whenever there's these cases related to like one business versus the other suing each other about anti-competitive stuff or like IP theft or whatever, when this litigation drags on for like 10 years, the analysts in the stock market just want certainty, and the business themselves just want certainty. At some point they go, rule one way or another, we just want to know, because the uncertainty is causing bigger issues than us, like, figuring out what to do with this safety net cash we don't know how to price this in. And that's kind of the way I feel about AI right now, where it's like some of the uncertainty about how it's going to be regulated is concerning for people who are starting to work on things right now. It's like, is this going to be a crime in the future?
Right, exactly. Are we going to spend all of this R&D and time and stuff developing this product that's going to end up having to get pulled off the market because of some ruling that happens a year from now that makes it illegal?
Or because I live in California and my business is based in California or something like that.
Right, yeah. Am I running afoul of, you know, some GDPR style regulation now?
Yeah. Which exists. I mean, this has happened in Europe, right? Some of the Meta's Llama products are not available in Europe.
Yeah.
And so we'll see how that all shakes out. I mean, it's interesting. we got some more, and we're gonna move to wrap in a few minutes here. So where do you want to go to next?
So I think the next or probably last thing maybe we'll discuss, or second to last thing, I guess, before we wrap, is Intel considering options such as a foundry split. We discussed this on a previous episode about Intel, and I think I used the term systemic rot, which I'm sure everyone had a reaction to. But Intel's now considering options.
I just had one, yeah.
one of which is splitting out Foundry, which, as we know, is bleeding mountains of cash. I think what's interesting about this is, you know, AMD successfully did this. I mean, that's what Global Foundries, that's why they exist. I mean, that was AMD's business that they spun out and were like, we don't want to do this anymore. In-house, so we're going to create Global Foundries and we'll have a special relationship with them where, like, they manufacture all our stuff. At least that's how it was at the time they spun it out.
How'd that work out? Yeah.
So would Intel really spin out the Foundry business? And then the question becomes, okay, well, Foundry has received piles of cash from the CHIPS Act. So where does that money go? Does it stay with Intel, or does it move to this new foundry business that could potentially be spun out, yet to be named.
Yeah. So I think there's a we kind of said it earlier, which is like, well, first of all, wait and see. But second of all, it's some of the backdrop of how Intel was lobbying in the 80s when Japan's chip industry was coming up, I think is really important here, where yeah, it probably makes sense for Foundry to be its own entity that can be treated as a matter of national security and funded by the US government taxpayer and their, consumer and data center business that sells all over the world to kind of operate as its own thing. You have to imagine they're already doing this, but two different stock tickers, probably two different CEOs, probably makes a lot of sense. So we'll see what happens. I think it's an unbelievably complicated and technical position to be in to try to be running this company right now. So I don't envy Pat at all. And I think the comment about systemic rot is like funny and a little bit off the cuff
Of
and
course.
really just like frankly not true when they're making leading edge processors that compete right against AMD and all the leading edge stuff. And like
I
the silicon
know.
exists. So, okay,
I
it's
know.
manufactured at TSMC, but like, come on. It's
It's
not
a
quite.
yeah, it's a bit of a joke to evoke a reaction. I do think though that there are probably some issues that have been going on with like what is you could almost equate it as like a personality crisis in a sense of like Intel has a massive like presence in the world and they sell to everybody and they've been making leading edge chips forever, right? But then the making part of it, the foundry business, is a whole, it's like a completely separate company, right? Like it's a
Yeah.
separate way you do business and it's set, like supply chain and all this other stuff, right? Like, so maybe like it's a thing where like Intel, at least internally, has been like, we make chips and we sell chips. The whole vertical integration story. But maybe they're kind of those two sides have been fighting with each other. I mean, I always said that, HP prior to the separation, I always said that like it makes sense, right? Because are we a data center company or are we a personal laptop and desktop and printer company? Right? Why are we both? Why are we sharing one R&D budget? Why are we like doing all these things, right? Like just separate it out. It makes a lot more sense. That way you can go be a data center company and we'll be a PC company. I feel like Intel may be at that inflection point right now where it's like, okay, we're gonna be a sales, company and we're gonna sell awesome chips and like whatever. But the making of the chips, right? So we'll keep design. We'll keep sales, we'll keep all this other stuff, but the manufacturing part, that's its own company now. Like that way both companies flourish, basically, is the kind of the thinking behind that. At least that's the way that I look at it.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's hard to, we were just talking about the regulatory stuff at the highest level with the biggest companies. It's hard to apply that logic in my mind to Intel and then not apply it to Google search, YouTube, and
Yeah.
et cetera, GCP, right? Amazon, like .com and AWS. It's like there's a lot of and especially when actually I just made the comment about how there's a the US is lagging behind China in research, right? I'm not big on big tech, but they have unbelievable budgets to dedicate to research and do incredible research and lead the business world in this. And I think if there's one way to criticize this policy institute, it's that the research for these big tech companies is mostly related to their core business. But if you look at Google, it's like it's really not. Mm-hmm. And they both fund academia and operate kind of industrial labs that are doing incredible stuff. And that putting a hamper on, an even bigger hamper on U.S. research, or at least making research focus on the business problems of today as opposed to futuristic stuff, is a concern. It seems like there's a lot going on right now to kind of tamp down on investments with long time horizons,
mm-hmm.
which is fundamentally what research is, right?
Right. You know. Yeah, I mean, there's papers I've read, you know, on like silicon photonics is a great example. Like the first paper that was published on that was 1996. We're just now starting to see the fruits of that in the form of CXL take form and enter the market.
Mm-hmm.
How many years has it been? Right. I mean, that was a paper. It took 20 plus years for everyone else to catch up. Manufacturing processes and design and chip design and all this other, it took everyone else to basically catch up, all the way up to the operating system supporting CXL devices, right? And device calls and stuff like that. So I think that is a case that in my mind, like, underscores the importance of far forward research, because it has a very real effect on the world. Yeah, it might take 20 years, but like it ends up having a very real effect on things. And so to tamp it down is short-sighted, I think.
Yeah, I don't know if what I'm saying equates. Like if you say, hey, split up big companies, will that actually tamp down research? But fundamentally, it seems that way right now, because all of the big labs are doing all of the big research.
Yeah.
You know, we don't get the arms race of AI right now, if not for Zuckerberg pushing out Llama, at least as fast as it's happening.
Right.
So it's like, you want to go break up Facebook? I don't know. Will we get Llama 4 if that happens?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of the point I'm trying to make. So anyway.
No, it's a very valid point, I think, and one that is important to keep into consideration. Like, are we stifling long-term research and innovation for the sake of, you know, going to war with big tech? All right. Well, I guess what I did want to end on as part of our wrap up is maybe I'll try to introduce this every week going forward, but the 180 of the week, as I'm calling it. So April 5th, 2023, Goldman Sachs analysts published an article that says generative AI could raise global GDP by 7%. Fast forward to 1 year from then, Gen AI, too much spend, too little benefit. So it appears that Goldman Sachs is now of the opinion of Sequoia Capital that, we're just not seeing a 7% GDP increase right now. What's interesting about this, though, is that I think it goes to your point of what we were talking about during the code assistance portion of, like, people need to tamper down their expectations and expect a longer time horizon for a lot of these things to happen. We're just not seeing the, and also I would say, I guess it makes all those like alarmist people on Twitter look like, or X look like, idiots now that were saying that AI is going to take over the world in 6 months and we're all going to be out of a job. And that's why we need, you know, universal basic income and all this other shit. Like, it hasn't happened yet. I mean, granted, sure, it's only been a year, but it hasn't happened yet. I think things are just moving at a slower pace than everyone thought they were going to move at.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a hard time forecasting exponentials. It's
Yep.
either much too fast or much too slow. Yeah, I think there's a lot to dig into on the financial analyst aspect of AI, whether it's too much investment. The biggest thing that comes to mind is just the statements that both Satya for Microsoft and Larry Page for Google have made, which is that this is like existential and I think a personal passion for these guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they have some way to justify spending this money on GPUs and people, which is like, we're going to create super intelligence, AGI, the God, the API call to God,
Skynet,
whatever you want to call it. it's uncapped upside, and therefore there's uncapped investment that can be made at this level. And so why not go and pour in tens of billions and let's see. But the other point I want to make is just that, like, Goldman Sachs seems to be, and others seem to be, criticizing the amount of investment that the largest tech companies have made in this transformational technology, which is not in the form of cash. A lot of it is in the form of credits or some sort of rental transfer payment thing. We're going to go buy NVIDIA GPUs, stick them in a data center, and let you use them for a couple of years. And we're going to call that, the result of that, we're going to call that a $5 billion valuation of your startup or whatever it is, right? And that's a weird business practice that hasn't existed before. It does mean NVIDIA is going through the roof, or the people who create the TPUs for Google, like Broadcom and stuff. All the networking vendors, yada, yada. But I think the point I would want to make is that these companies are so wildly successful. They have 10, 20, 30, 40 more billions of dollars to spend on building out massive compute infrastructure, improving their power, you know, footprint for creating these data centers, and recruiting incredibly talented people to work hard on something they're passionate about. Like, yeah. If you're like, hey, Zuckerberg, why would you possibly spend $25 billion on this thing? He's like, well, I have $25 billion to spend. And that's a lot of H100s and a lot of people, right? So, I mean, criticizing that from a financial perspective, oh, he will not return 10x on his $25 billion is like fair enough. But I'm not sure that's the calculation that's being made. I think these people like Larry Page and Satya and Zuckerberg, they really care about the outcome. They're really passionate about it. They're interested in it. And they view themselves as like overseeing a little bit of an empire. Mm-hmm. And so why have I been building up this war chest to spend it on this stuff, right? What else am I going to spend it on?
Right.
Peter Thiel famously criticized Eric Schmidt when he was running Google, saying, why do you buy back your stock? Have you run out of ideas? Would you rather these people be buying back their stock? Or is it okay that they spend a bit of money on GPUs and power and overpay some engineers, right? I don't have a lot of problem with it. And I don't think there's a big expectation to return 10x in 10 years on this investment that's happening right now.
Yeah, I think their point is more of like a macro view of not just the hyperscalers, but your average Fortune 500 company spending a bunch of money and maybe, you know, only...
Maybe it's the VCs.
Yeah.
So I agree that it's the Fortune 500. Probably let's not be a, you know, traditional retailer spending 10% of our R&D budget on this thing. Let's wait for everybody else to battle it out and then reap the benefits, take the free trials and stuff. I think it's venture capital is a huge issue. If you're running a VC firm managing money for like firefighters' pensions and teachers' pensions, and you're tossing them at somebody who's going to go compete with Google and Facebook and Microsoft to build a foundation model to the tune of $1 billion. Like that's crazy.
Yeah, that is legitimately like you just went to the casino and put it all on black, like that.
Yeah, and the rumors. I mean, Reid Hoffman made this statement about inflection that the investors got a 1x. So these guys got to go play around. They didn't get acquired by Microsoft, but the company got signed an exclusive licensing deal, and then everybody who worked for the company moved over to work for Microsoft. So it's basically an acquisition that just avoids the
regulatory
oversight.
Scrutiny. Yeah.
And so what did the company do? They spent like 60% of their venture capital buying 22,000 H100s, and now I think a company acquires that and the people who've been working hard and learning something. So they have an outcome, which is a 1x outcome. It's probably not what you're looking for when you're investing $1 billion into something.
No, I mean, anytime you at least talk to anybody in the financial space, I mean, they're looking for 10x. They're looking for, a minimum of 10x their return on investment. You know, even if you watch something as like Shark Tank on CNBC, right? Like, these people come on, they pitch the product to like Mark Cuban and O'Leary and, you know, Kevin O'Leary and all these other people. And it's like, they're sitting in that chair looking for, can I get at least a 5x, 10x return on my stake, right? Like, if I'm going to go throw money at this, like, do I see a path forward here?
Yeah.
And I don't know that that expectation is necessarily realistic as it relates to the AI space today.
Yeah, when the when the denominator for your multiple is $1 billion,
yeah,
it's very hard to go 10x. Much much harder than going 10x on a million. So
for sure,
let's see what everybody's shooting for. That's a cool way to wrap, man. We're excited about AI. I think we started out talking about AI, and we ended finishing with AI, because all you do now is AI.
That's it, man. That's all I do. Tune in next week to find out how many more times I can say AI on a single podcast.
All right. Take care, everyone.
All right.